beautiful state of our United States and another part of the world that God's created. Just a wonderful time of year. The weather couldn't have been better, I don't think. I don't know. Maybe you do have better weather than this, but it's sort of hard to imagine. But it's been a wonderful time, and your hospitality and kindness and words of encouragement have meant so much to me, and I want to thank you so much from the depth of my heart. Our final discussion this morning is going to deal with the city of Jerusalem. And I've sort of taken the title of this from the passage where Jesus is looking over the city near the end of his life on earth. And you can almost hear him groaning out with this expression, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. How often I would have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you would not. See, your house is left to you desolate. For I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" One of the meanings of the term Jerusalem that often occurs is the word city of peace. If you know anything about world history, this is one of the most egregious misnomers that exist. I mean, of all the cities on the face of the earth, this one seems to have seen less peace than any other that exists. But that's not to say that it doesn't offer peace in some fashion. The events of redemption and salvation, God has focused upon this city. A city where these events have had such global and universal kind of impact, to the point that you and I can tap into the peace that is available through the Son of Man who died there. What I want to do this morning is to look at a survey of some aspects, this is not going to be exhaustive, of the city of Jerusalem, beginning with David. And then we're going to end with a discussion of aspects, at least, of the crucifixion and the burial of Jesus. But as we think in terms of this, the small city of David that David captures is, again, quite small. As I've indicated earlier, the towns in the land of Canaan and Palestine never were very large. Admittedly, during the time of Herod, they did get larger than were typically the case in the Old Testament. But the Old Testament city that David conquers is about 7 to 10 acres in area, and that's about it. And this is a model representing that portrayal. And as we think in terms of a top map looking at this, it's this spur of land that we have that is portrayed here. There's the Valley of Kidron that is on the eastern side. This is the Cheesemaker's Valley that Don relishes in. Also known as the Tyropean. And this is the Valley of Hinnom. It comes over in this direction. Now, to a large extent, this section, which portrays the expansion of the city under the reign of Hezekiah, was not characteristic of most of the Old Testament town. This was the Old Testament town, and then it extended northward when the temple was going to be built and was built by Solomon. Again, it's quite a small area relative to what we normally think in terms of, but very, very important. When David captures this, it's through a rather interesting strategy, and we alluded to this, I think, on what Friday night when we were talking about Hezekiah and so forth. But the original water system was the means through which David and his army, more particularly Joab, is managing to get into the city and essentially open the gates to allow David to conquer it. And the entrance into the water system is through this little opening that is slightly wider than my shoulders, not too much taller than I, with this corbelled roof that you have at the top. This is original. This has not been reconstructed. This dates from the time of before David, but this is part of the system that was utilized as David issues the challenge. Whoever gets up the water course will be the commander of the army. And Joab takes up the challenge, and he's going to manage to get through this in some fashion. We don't know all the specifics, but David then brings the city of Jerusalem under the care and auspices of himself, narrated in 2 Samuel chapter 5. Now, as you look at this, this is the entrance into this. You can see some steps in the back, and those steps then descend through the ground. Now, the access and the rationale here is to get to the water supply, which is outside of the city. But they want to do it in the security as much as they can, and safety. And so there's this tunnel that goes from inside the city, underneath the city wall, and eventually will leave them exposed as they are going to fill their water sources and jars and then return to the inside of the city. But this is the tunnel that is there, and you are able to go through this. The Israelis have put a set of nice stairs here that make it a little bit easier, although they're really quite steep. They're not quite the slope that we're accustomed to. We sort of feel like we're going to fall over forward. So you hang on to the handrail, and you go down them. But as you get to the bottom, the last few steps are original from the construction of the tunnel, probably dating to maybe even as early as the time of the patriarchs, but we're not exactly sure. And you come to this section, and it smooths out, and this is a cut section drawing through this. There would be the entrance that we went in, and we go down the flight of steps, and we come to this tunnel that goes down out here, and eventually you're going to be exposed. The old city wall would have been up here. This is the inside of the city. This is the outside of the city. And so eventually you're going to be exposed. Lower your jars down into this pool where the spring feeds into this, and then fill your jars and go back up through that into the interior of the town. And this appears to have been the system through which Joab is going to go, through the water system, the water shaft, and basically go in and then open the gates. Now, the people in Jerusalem at this point were so self-confident, and probably partly because they'd been there several hundred years with the Israelites all around them, and Israel had never conquered them. Now, how much effort there had been to do so, I don't know. But they talk about, in a contemptuous kind of way, the lame and the blind will be able to keep you at bay. And, you know, this would be like basketball trash talk, okay? And the Israelites, and particularly Joab, is just incensed by this. And David is as well. And probably it reflects a overconfident attitude that they didn't need to have themselves posted here to protect the site. And Joab is able to get inside this and is able to open the gates, and David captures the city. So this is the old water system. Now, eventually, with Hezekiah, we chatted on Friday evening about that, Hezekiah is going to improve the system so there won't be this vulnerability out here. And this is what this is portraying, is the Hezekiah's tunnel that's going to tap in and take the water to another location. So there's a design shift that takes place. But this is, it's thrilling to go here and see this and to realize you are in the location where all of these events unfold and the exhilarating reality of how this works. There are a lot of places that sometimes the tour guides will take you that, yeah, right, sure. And that's sort of the way you react. But there are other places that, yes, this is it. And this is one of those locations. Now, David, the Bible will say that David then builds from the Milo inward and strengthens and fortifies the city. Now, again, this is the model of the city. But you see this little array of what looks like nothing there. This is actually the portrayal of what that is. This is the mantle of the Milo that is there. And this rather steep slope. And this is a revetment that the Israelites, or actually earlier folks, had built. The earlier Jebusites had built to stabilize the wall and the hillside so it won't landslide down the slope. Now, on top of this, up here, there have recently been found what appear to be, and I'm inclined to agree with her, Elat Mizar has found the footings and the foundations of what she postulates was part of David's palace. And I tend to agree with her. I think she has a reasonable case there. And with the massiveness of that architecture that is there, which probably to an extent was an embellishment of the earlier Jebusite fortress that was there, all that weight would require some stabilization of the hillside so the palace won't go sliding down the slope. You know, sound like Hollywood and the mudslides that sometimes we hear reports on. And so that's the purpose of that mantle and the Milo that is there, strengthening from the Milo inward. And the Bible is very explicit about this in 2 Samuel chapter 5. And this is probably what is under consideration there. Now, this is an interesting view of the real location, not just a drawing. Here's the Kidron Valley, Okay, and this is the Valley of the Cheesemakers. Now, much of it has been filled in with debris. It's piled in, and so it's built up, so it's fairly smooth across there, although the depression originally was much more significant. This is where the temple eventually would be built. It is now surmounted, and the temple, of course, is destroyed by the Romans eventually in 70 AD, and eventually then the Islamic people are going to come and build the Golden Dome on that platform and that location where the temple was. There's a lot of development that is over here, but I want us to consider a few things as we look at this. I hope it's okay I'm down here, because I'm going to be pointing at a lot of stuff, and it's easier for me to see it and to discuss it from here. But this is, again, where that original city of David was, the part that David captures. And then they extend it northward when Solomon builds the temple and so forth. But along the east side there are a bunch of rock-hewn tombs along the Kidron Valley. Some of these are really fascinating. Now, I've not been in any of these because of the awkwardness and the political volatility of the area. I promised my wife I would try to steer clear of those kind of places. Sometimes people ask me, is it safe to travel over there? And my response was, okay, is it safe to go to Portland? And the reaction is, well, it depends on where you... Well, that's exactly. It depends on where you go. I mean, so there are places you just sort of stay away from, and this is one of those that I stay away from. But you can see the tombs from across the way. But one of the tombs that is in that is the tomb of the royal steward. The Hebrew phrase that translates into who is over the house, and the pronunciation of that is the Asher ol Habayit. And that literally means who is over the house. Now, this actually becomes the title of an office in the court of the Israelites. So the royal steward, which is an adequate kind of portrayal and expression, but that's not the way the Hebrews would have said it. They would have said, Shebna, who is over the house. And he would be sort of like the chief of staff of the president. Okay, so the one that would be in charge of who sees the president and what his schedule is and sort of protects him and public relations and all that kind of stuff. And that's what the who is over the house is. Now, this is the tomb of someone who is over the house. Now, tombs in this part of the world, and we're going to deal a lot with tombs this morning. So I hope I'm not going to try to be grisly on you, but nonetheless, we have to be real in how this is going to work. But to here you have the doorway into the tomb, and there's a window that is there, and the scale is there to give some sense of proportion and ratio. But I have a drawing here that helps clarify some of it. That's the doorway into the inside, and here is the window. Now, I've never been inside this, but I infer that it's probably about the size of a third of this auditorium. Plenty large. You can walk around in it. It's a sizable kind of room and so forth. Here's the door, there's the window and so forth. And originally there was an inscription in this area. You see that indentation where it's been carved in. Well, this is where an inscription was there that is now in the British Museum. And the inscription reads, very importantly, this is the tomb of Shebna Yahu, who is over the house. Now, that's our Hebrew phrase out of the inscription. The Asher ol Habayit. There is no silver or gold here, but his bones with the bones of his ama with him. The word ama basically refers to his concubine. Cursed be the man who will open this. Now, the idea here is, okay, there's nothing of wealth here. There's nothing of value here. Leave us alone. Let us rest in peace. All right, so just leave us alone. Now, whether people are going to follow that or not is another question. Do they believe that? And that is where part of the problem arises. And you'll notice the way the inscription is written, there's part of it that is in brackets. That actually is this marred section right there, and we're not sure exactly what it reads, but this is the reconstruction of even non-believing scholars who have looked at the inscription and so forth. And they think that this is the way it should be reconstructed. Now, what happens is there's actually a connection, probable connection, I would argue almost certain connection, in Isaiah chapter 22. Because there is someone in the narrative who is known as Shebna, who is, in the Bible, who is over the house. Okay. And Isaiah is going to talk about him and listen to what is said here. Now, a tomb like this would belong to somebody of some influence as well. the everyday kind of folk, like probably most all of us, we would just be buried out in a hole in the ground, sort of like, you know, we're familiar with, without a coffin. But we, you know, the hole would be dug, we'd be placed in it, and then we'd be covered up. But this is a tomb belonging to the wealthy folks. But in Isaiah chapter 22, beginning in verse 15, thus says the Lord God of hosts, come, go to the steward, to Shebna, who is over the household. That's actually the title of his role. And say to him, what have you to do here, and whom have you here that you have cut out here a tomb for yourself, who cut out a tomb on the height and carved a dwelling for yourself in the rock? Wow. I mean, boom, 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 boom. All kinds of things suddenly resonate in all of this. Behold, the Lord will hurl you away violently, you strong man. He will seize firm hold of you and whirl you around and around and throw you like a ball into a wide land, and there you shall die, and there shall be your glorious chariots, you shame of your master's house. Now, we don't know what Shebna did that invited this kind of indictment. Now, if you're thinking carefully, you probably say, wait a minute, that can't be Shebna's tomb because the Bible says that Shebna's going to die in another land. Well, hold your horses here. Most all of us are familiar with the Egyptian stuff, and a new pharaoh comes to the throne, new king comes to the throne back in the third millennium, and he begins immediately to prepare for his own demise. I mean, you don't wait till you die in order to build a pyramid. You don't wait till you die to carve out all of those tombs, such as what was the case with Tutankhamun and so forth. You begin those preparations before. And probably what's happened here is his ama, his concubine, is probably already passed. And she is interred here. And the inscription is sort of anticipating the time when he's going to die and be in there. But the Lord comes along and says, you aren't going to be in that tomb that you're preparing. You're going to be dead somewhere else. Now, the style of writing of all of this, the location, and the fact that you do have him described as who is over the house, points dramatically to it's probably Shebna. And hence the reconstruction of this reading. And we can't be absolutely certain of this identity, but it's nonetheless a tantalizing one. And I would argue almost certain. But as we look at this, what's peculiar is that, well, let me come back to this. This structure is now somebody's house. Somebody lives in the tomb. Obviously, they did not respect, stay out of the house, leave unless rest in peace. Now, I don't know when all of this occurred, but nonetheless, it's now somebody's home. Sort of a weird kind of... Anyway. Now, this is another tomb complex to the north of the city of Jerusalem. And this is from the time of the divided monarchy, dating from about 920 to about 586 BC, apparently used over a period of time. And a couple of features I want to point out here that are really interesting. Obviously, there's a significant complexity to this. This is more complex than the other one. This is a family tomb, a classic family tomb in the ancient world. Now, when Abraham, for instance, buys the cave of Machpelah, where he's going to bury Sarah, it's designed to be a family tomb. So multiple generations were going to be interred there, and that is clear in the biblical text of Genesis. So we have something similar here, but from a later period. So you have this main entrance chamber, and radiating off of it are these various rooms. Now, if you look at this, you'll see, look, for instance, over here, you have what looks like a drawing here, but this is actually sort of about a table. Sort of like tables that are sort of carved into the side. So you'd walk from this chamber into the central part of that, and then you would be surrounded by benches that are there. So you have a bench here, and a bench at the front, and then the doors behind you. And so you walk in, and here's a bench, there's a bench, here's a bench. All right. And these are intended to hold individuals as they would pass from this life. Now, another thing you'll notice are these little curved things that you have, some of them scattered around, and the little curved things are raised elements in the stone where you would lay the head of the deceased into this little cradle, and the head would be, you know, facing up rather than the head flop around. Now, people in the ancient world would typically bury individuals the same day that they pass. And so this is part of what's going on here. And so, as we look at this, and you'll see some of them have two of them, okay? So we're going to count either the little, I refer to them as the horseshoe things, But the headrest, all right, little headrest. And if there's one there, then we'll go with one. If there's two there, we'll go with two. If it doesn't have one, we'll assume it's one, all right? So what we would have is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. There's a fragment of one there. 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. So there'd be place for 21 people there. Of course, then the lurking question is, what happens with number 22? Well, if you're here for the Bible class session, you sort of already might be ahead of me here. When it gets to that point, then they would gather up the bones of one of the individuals and deposit them in a cave. That's what the gray area is. And notice how it stops at the edge of this. So the opening here is like that. And they would take the bones and just sort of dump them into this cave. This is actually in that tomb complex. And to us, this seems very cavalier. But to the people in this part of the world, this was respectful. This is, you remember the phrase in the Bible, being gathered to one's fathers? This is actually part of the dynamic there, being buried in the family tomb. Jacob, for instance, you may recall, say, when I die, he's in Egypt, when I die, take me back to the cave of Machpelah and bury me in the tomb where Abraham buried Sarah, and Abraham is buried, and Isaac and Rebekah are buried, and I buried Leah, and, you know, the family tomb. Be gathered to one's fathers. Now, I'm not going to argue that they thought that was necessarily the end of everything, but that When particularly my mother passed away, one of the things that she wanted, and she'd take me back and bury me in the family cemetery back in Dunlap, Tennessee. Okay. It was very important to her. Now, I don't, you know, whether she's conscious of all that or not now, I don't know. And probably not. But nonetheless, it's the honor and respect to my mother, my father, both of whom are buried side by side now in the family plot there in Dunlap, Tennessee. I want to respect them and honor them by following through with that. And so this is what we have here. Now, there's another tomb that I want to talk about that has some other significance. I've excavated at this one about 1990 or so, 89, 90. And I was working there, and you'll notice the drawing. You have, again, this sort of headrest that are there. This one's designed a little bit differently. And although there's a lot of similarity, there's the opening, you walk into the standing area, there's the benches around it, but these would radiate off, and there's the little cave that the bones would be deposited in. And here is what it looks like now. The top of it's missing because it's been quarried away for stone, for building other kind of stuff, and the bottom of this is still there. But this is sort of what it would have looked like. And see the headrest, and here are some of us checking out how it feels. That's me right there. All right. Long time ago, you talk about old photographs. That's my hair was dark, and back in the day, I had hair. Okay, anyway, but this is the way that looked. Now the cave is there on the face here, underneath on this side, and the cave is right there. And when the archaeologist Gabriel Barkai discovered this, this one was still intact as far as the material remains inside the little cave. And so they excavated out all these bones and the grave goods and jewelry and everything else that is associated with it. And a couple of items that came to light were very fascinating. I mean, a lot of it was very fascinating, but two in particular just highlighted the issue. And this is one of them. Now, the length of this, as you go from here to here, is about 3/4 of an inch. But the archaeologists recognized this is something a little different. What is this? They recognized this is metal of some kind, and it turned out to be metal rolled up. It's a piece of silver that is rolled up. And as they unrolled it, it had an inscription on it. I affectionately refer to it, not in a contemptuous kind of way, I affectionately refer to it as the chewing gum inscription. And the reason for that is if you remember when you were a child and you would get the stick of beech nut or peppermint or whatever, so many of us would take our gum and roll it up. And that's exactly what's happened here. They've taken this inscription, they've rolled it up, and there would be a hole in the middle, and it would be have a chain or a string or something, and they wear it as a necklace or a bracelet or something, sort of an amulet kind of thing. But the inscription reads, "The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make His face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift His countenance upon you and give you peace." It's a slightly varied form of this, but it's very clear resonating with this. This actually, you know, you often hear about the Dead Sea Scrolls as the oldest manuscript of the Bible that we have. This actually is older than the Dead Sea Scrolls. This dates the time of Josiah. This dates the time of Josiah. And it says something about the faith system of at least someone connected with the tomb. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean the individual's worshiping the Lord properly or not, but nonetheless, I think the time of Josiah, there were some who were doing so, certainly. Josiah was attempting to do so, and I suspect Josiah was attempting to persuade others, as was Jeremiah trying to persuade as well. But a lot of it didn't get traction. But these are some of the reflections of the people of the ancient world. Now, transitioning into the New Testament era, dealing with Jerusalem. This is a view of the Dome of the Rock, that is the mosque. No, it's actually not a mosque, but it's a monument connected with the Islam religion. And the foreground here is the Western Wall. What I said, Wailing Wall. It's the Western Wall. And sometimes it's called the Wailing Wall, but they prefer you not to use that terminology. But this is a retaining wall associated with the construction of the area, the expansion of the platform under the building project of Herod the Great. And the stones down at the bottom in particular, up to about right there, and then they start breaking apart. You can see those are very different than the ones down lower. But those are the stones that originally were part of the Herodian construction. Now this has turned into a big synagogue. This is the men's side, and this wall then over here is the women's side. And they'll gather in their outdoor synagogue, and this is where they'll worship and so forth. But synagogue worship, at least here, is not as corporate like we think in terms of it. It's more individualized in character, although there will be groups of people that are involved. Now, as we look at that, the model, if you ever go to Jerusalem, I highly recommend, if you can, to go to the model of the first century city. It's huge. It's several times the size of this auditorium. And it is a portrayal of the city of Jerusalem about 65 AD, about 5 years before the Romans destroy it. And it's a wonderful orientation as to what you are going to see or what you have seen. And ideally, you ought to go there before you go in the rest of it, and then you go there after you go to the rest of it. Okay, so that you see before and after kind of things. But the Western Wall would have been over there that we were looking at. But as we look at this, see this archway that is here? The remnants of the springer of that arch still exist. And, you know, that protrusion out of the side of the wall is that what's known as the springer, that is the beginning of that arch. And this dates from, I mean, Jesus would have seen this. And then you start to, ooh, wow. You know, so this is not at this holy ground. Okay, I'm not going there. But to realize you're looking at something that Jesus would have seen. And you know, there's a connection across time in a different kind of way. And so there you are looking at that. And on the south end, when the Israelis took over the city in 1967 with the Six-Day War, they feverishly went in and began very systematically to excavate as much as they could, thinking they were going to have to turn this all back over to the Arabic custody, the Palestinian custody. Of course, this is still a huge bone of contention in the politics of the period. I'm not going to get involved in all of that, but this is just the situation as it is. And so they feverishly began excavating all of this, and they uncovered these steps on the south side of that temple complex. This is, again, part of the Herodian stuff, particularly that layer right there. The rest of it is all reconstructed from later periods. But these steps are there, and the ragged part are actually the original steps. The crisper ones are the reconstruction, but the ragged part are the original steps that were from the time of Herod. And as you look at this, we're looking at the model here, shows the steps and so forth, and that rubble that is there represents the ruins of that. And that was what the offices, we think, of the administrators of the temple area. And then the steps, of course, are portrayed there. And here is a picture of my wife standing on those raw steps from the time of Herod. And, wow. Now, the temple area itself is huge. It's massive. And if you've ever been to a congregation that had, I mean, this is a weirdly laid out building. All right. I don't know what all is over on that side, but over on this side it's like, huh, where am I? You know, and, you know, doors all over the place and everything else. And there's a tendency for people, particularly in a building that is large and has a lot of openings, they'll sort of customarily use one or two of them. and not use the others. Now, I don't know if Jesus did that or not. Did he go through all the openings going into the temple? I don't know. He may never use this to get into the temple area, but I'm sure he was aware of it. I'm sure he was aware of it. And it's sort of exciting to see that. Now, this again is the model, and this is a representation of the temple based upon the descriptions that we have in Philo, Josephus, the New Testament, other sources that are rabbinic sources and so forth. Obviously, there is some artistic license because we don't know exactly everything, but it's a reasonable reconstruction. Now, if you want to think in terms of the area simply of that, that's probably about half the size of this auditorium. I mean, this is a large, large model, but it's a massive kind of area. And this is their portrayal of the temple. This would be Solomon's porch, where the book of Acts will talk about the first century disciples meeting from time to time for their worship and praise and so forth. And so it would have been down here. This is the court of the Gentiles and the court of the Gentiles. Now, names usually mean something. You know, people don't name something just willy-nilly, you know, out of the air. And so, again, if it's the court of the Gentiles, it tends to imply the Gentiles, it's okay for the Gentiles to be here. All right. Now, there's a point at which the Gentiles would not be permitted to go. All right. Which is understandable. Okay. It's a sacred site associated with the Hebrew people, with the Jewish people, and you just don't want anybody coming in there because you want to keep the respect of the God of Israel kind of thing. And that's sort of the mindset that they have here. Now, a closer look at that. And what I want you to see is this wall right here. And there's, you can see a fragment of it on the other side, and it totally surrounded the temple itself. And this is what made the demarcation between the court of the Gentiles and then the temple. And in that little wall, there were signs every now and then. And Josephus describes these signs as being about every 30 cubits or so. All right. And the sign looks like this. This is one of them, the only two of these that have been found in the excavations and so forth. This is the most complete one. It is in the Istanbul Museum in Istanbul. And part of one is in the Israel Museum, but the part of one is just about half of it. But this is the whole thing. And as you read this, it sounds like a lawyer. Now, I'm not knocking lawyers here, but if anybody's a lawyer, you'll readily, and all of us will readily recognize this, because there's a vindication of, I'm not responsible for what happens, and it translates, no alien may enter within the barrier and the wall around the temple, and whoever is caught is alone responsible for the death which follows. Doesn't that sound like a lawyer? Okay, so absolving themselves, it's your own fault. All right. This wall plays a big role in the life of Paul. Acts chapter 21, Paul has returned from his last missionary journey. And he meets with the apostles that are still in Palestine, and talks with them, and they said, you know, rumors are going around that you totally disrespect the law, but we have some people here ending a vow, and we want you to go with them and end your vow at the temple and pay their way. And so this is sort of to pave things over and smooth things over a bit. So Paul does so. And as he does so, at the end of the 7 days, some Asiatics who are there have seen Paul in the city with Trophimus, who is a Gentile. And the text is very explicit about this. And they then accuse Paul of bringing a Gentile into the temple. Well, it would be bringing Paul, the Gentiles past this wall. Obviously, and this is why I emphasize, court of the Gentiles, okay. I mean, that's why it's called the court of the Gentiles. It's okay for them to be there. But they're charging Paul with breaching that wall with these Gentiles into the temple area. Paul had more sense than to do something like that. But the accusation has been made. The feelings and heightened kind of anger and so forth, and a riot begins to erupt. And Paul then is taken into custody and is going to be taken into the Antonia Fortress, which is at the northwest corner of the temple area. And while he's there, he asks the tribune, and says, I would like to speak with the people. And the tribune says, do you know Greek? And he says, I have raised in Tarsus of Cilicia, no mean city, but I've been raised and educated in Jerusalem. And there's a discussion, but finally the tribune says, okay, you can talk to the people. So Paul begins to talk, Acts chapter 22, to this mob that is there. They all quiet down and they listen. until Paul gets to the point where he says, God has sent the gospel message to the Gentiles, and it goes nuts again. And the tribune then brings Paul into the citadel to protect him. Paul's nephew finds out about a conspiracy of some Jews who are going to say, we're not going to eat or drink anything until Paul is dead. And the nephew tells Paul. Paul says, okay, go tell the tribune. And then Paul is going to be shuttled off under cover of darkness to Caesarea Maritima, where he's going to stay imprisoned for about 3 years. Eventually appealing to Caesar and then shuttled off to Rome, where he has his hearing before Nero. All of that revolves around a charge connected with that wall. Now, the Bible doesn't specifically say anything about it, but if you know the lay of the land, literally in this case, if you know the lay of the land, it all begins to make much better sense. Now, when I talk about a wall, it sounds moderately political. I'm not getting into this discussion either, but it's just sort of an interesting coincidence here. But this wall that we're talking about is the issue that was the focal point of the charges that were made. So as we unfold this, Paul, I'm going to shift gears now and move to Jesus. There's the Antonia Fortress. You can see part of it over there. But this is the palace of Herod the Great. There's a big discussion that goes on in the academic world about where was the hearing that when Jesus had his hearing before Pilate. Now, many people argue it was in the Antonia Fortress over there, which was a citadel. Others will argue that it was here in Herod's palace. Now, let me ask you this. If you, and I'm not suggesting that you do this, but if you were a decadent Roman, don't do that, but if you were a decadent Roman, where would you rather stay? In a palace that has fountains and gardens and walking areas, is secure because it's basically a fortress in and of itself. All of the eating facilities that you could imagine, resources for all of the luxuries of life and plenty of room and away from the hubbub and all of that, with its own element of protection and contingencies of army, or a fortress that is just a fortress. Well, I think if you're a decadent Roman, you'd rather stay here. Herod didn't live in there anymore. He's dead. This is vacant for all practical purposes. And Pontius Pilate likely, and that's all I'm going to say, likely would have been here. And probably this is where the hearing before Pilate took place. But it really is not important to know that exact location. But this does raise an interesting question. Okay, where was Jesus crucified? Well, notice how I phrase this, the new traditional Golgotha. You look at this, use your imagination, you can see sort of a skullish look to it, it's a place of the skull. The problem with this is that, and there's a background I don't have time to go into, but the problem with this is that this actually is a result of the Middle Ages when it was used as a stone quarry. And this results from that. However, just literally a stone's throw away, if you can throw very far, which I can't, bad shoulders, all right. But literally a stone's throw away is this wonderful looking tomb that is in a garden setting. And this is the draw of a lot of people. But the problem with this tomb is, one, typologically it is not the kind characteristic of the first century. And it's also part of that tomb complex where I showed you the picture of the bones. This is just the other side of that. It's actually part of the whole complex. So this probably dates, almost certainly dates from the divided monarchy rather than the first century. More likely location where Jesus was crucified and buried is at the site of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. I won't go into all the details, but this is a view of that. But as you go in, that's Golgotha. Most of us, we probably look at that and go, what's there? And you're much more inclined to think in terms of that other site that we looked at. Around the corner is the tomb, which is encased within all of this elaboration. There's much more evidence that points to this as a legitimate location, although for most people, they find it sort of... prefer the other one because it's more reflective and more conducive. And I'm okay with that. And again, it doesn't really matter. The where, the is what matters. The is what matters. But how did this work with Jesus? This is an artist's rendering of sort of a typical first century rich person's tomb. Very similar in some ways. You have the opening with the rolling stone that would seal it shut, the pit that is there. The body would be placed on the bench and left there for about a year, wrapped in linen with the spices. The spices are there to mask the odor of the process. They're not intended to be preservatives necessarily, but if you got to take another family member in within some period of time, you'd like the spices at least to sort of dampen this. Remember when Jesus comes to Lazarus? And the sisters say, "No." Jesus says, "Roll the stone away." "Oh, no, Lord, by now, you know, okay." And Jesus says, "Roll the stone away." All right. That's the spices. Now, they also become an homage and a respect thing that people will give because they love the individual. But this is the way this would work. And after about a year, the person's bones would be gathered up and put into... This is actually a drawing of a real one that was broken into by a backhoe in the waterwork system of Jerusalem. And this one was fascinating. I'm going to show you some elements of this. But again, you have the standing pit, the benches around it, the radiating chambers. And after the person has decayed, if you will, the bones are gathered up and put into a box, a stone box that looks something like this. This is one that's fancy. This belongs to somebody of some wealth, of some influence. And these tombs, by the way, quit just about 70 AD. Boom, when Jerusalem is destroyed and the Jews are largely suppressed. This kind of tomb burial did not characterize them after that, especially in Jerusalem. But this one obviously is quite fancy, and we know who is involved here. On the end of it, it has an inscription that says, "Joseph, the son of Caiaphas." Wow. Everybody that I've read is willing to concede this is probably Caiaphas the high priest. But who's the Joseph? Well, apparently he's the son of Caiaphas. That's about as far as we can go with it. But inside this box were the bones of six people. And probably it's the 60-year-old man that is the Joseph, the son of Caiaphas. This is what people would have thought would have happened to Jesus. Jesus is buried in a rich man's tomb, one in which nobody had been placed before. All right. And it would have been assumed by most people he'd be left there about a year and then bones gathered up and put in a box like this. Of course, 3 days later, it's empty. And part of the significance of the fact that the text says that it's a tomb where no one's been laid before is to eliminate that confusion that could have existed. I mean, there's nobody here. It's not, is this Jesus as opposed to this one? There's nobody here. It's gone. He's gone. And hence the angel says, he's not here, he's risen. Okay. I mean, this is the importance of all of that. Now, here we're looking at the only piece of evidence of a crucifixion that's ever been found. The only piece of evidence of a crucifixion that's ever been found. I have a full-size reproduction of that, issued by the Israel Antiquities Authority. And it has a nail through it. And the nail, this is the nail head, and it's bent on the end, and they think what happened is that the nail hit a knot in the olive wood post. They're able to analyze the wood that was attached to it. This was a bone that was in an ossuary, not the one we were looking at, but it was in an ossuary. And as you look at this, you probably wonder, what is that? Okay. What it is a foot. Part of a foot. And it's the nail through there, through the heel. And the postulate is that the individual here was attached to the cross like this, with the feet straddling the post, a nail through each heel bone going into the post. Now, mind you, this is the only piece of crucifixion that's ever been found that can be identified as such. A couple of questions, again, if you're thinking analytically, says, well, wait, you know, Jesus couldn't have been done that way. Not a bone of his body will be broken. I mean, that's usually a response, and it's a legitimate response. I've talked with the osteologist about this and asked them, and several of them, not just one or two. And I've asked him, okay, here's what we have. Tell me, talk to me. And they say, with a fresh body, which of course would be the case with Jesus, to drive a nail through that basically just drives a nail through it. It doesn't fracture it. Doesn't shatter it. The inside of this is sort of like a honeycomb. And this is very, very strong. But it's relatively light. And, you know, we're all the time putting our weight on this thing. All right. And so God has designed this very effectively. And they'll say, yeah, that makes perfectly good sense because it would be extremely difficult for the person to get off at all. Now, Josephus will talk about the destruction of the city of Jerusalem, which was several decades later. And it talks about the Romans doing so many crucifixions, they became creative as to how they did it. But at the time when Jesus is crucified, crucifixions were apparently not that overwhelmingly prevalent. So, again, we're operating on the only evidence that we actually have. The tradition of the nail through here is one that comes from like the 4th century A.D., for what that's worth. But there's another tweak to this. And I'll admit it's a tweak that someone in a lecture in Athens, Greece pointed out to me. He stopped me and he said, it wasn't in a worship service. He says, interesting, you shall bruise his head and he shall bruise your heel. I just got goosebumps thinking about that again. I'm not sure what to do with that. It's tantalizing. I have a homework assignment for you. Students at school don't like that. Next Lord's Day, when these trays are passed around, think about this. Jesus dies in the city of peace as a result not of peace but of intense violence. But he has come to give us peace so we can live in the city of peace. But we have to recognize he died for you and for me. And we have to listen to what his expectations are. And we have to submit ourselves, crowning him as Lord of our life, by humbling ourselves in repentance, confessing Jesus as the Son of God and as Lord of our life, and being baptized to have our sins washed away by the blood of the Lamb. Have you done that? Won't you do so if you haven't? Won't you come while we stand and sing?